Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kodalska. We sent out some of our reporters to hear how Wyomingites felt about the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump.
Well, I think it's a pretty sad state of the country that we're so divided up.
Summer heat is impacting river ecosystems and the fishing guides that rely on them.
We were putting the boat on floating at 6 a.m, which is pretty magical, but also kind of necessity.
And we continue to take a closer look at the primaries, this time Wyoming's lone congressional seat.
I'm going to continue to sponsor bills that are designed to protect women.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Grady Kirkpatrick, inviting you to join me for Wyoming Sounds. Along with your favorites, you'll discover plenty of new music. We bring you NPR news updates, weather, and we'll let you know about events happening around Wyoming. Wyoming Sounds from 9 to noon on Wyoming Public Radio and 24/7 online at wyomingsounds.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kodalska. Former President Donald Trump survived an attempted assassination at a rally. The political violence made many question the national rhetoric around politics today. We wanted to hear how this event impacted Wyomingites. So Wyoming Public Media reporters went out onto the streets of Cheyenne, Laramie, and Pinedale to listen. We start in Cheyenne, where state government reporter David Dudley spoke with Roof Duffy, Mike Theriot, Marilee Bobney, and Brett Knotts.
I was surprised that somebody would try something like that, but then when I saw that the guy was so young, it kind of was like, I don't know how he got affected or what happened, and we'll never really know.
It just goes to show how divided our country is right now. There's no doubt about it. Both sides have got to come together because this is unacceptable. Whether Republican or Democrat.
I think it's an absolute outrage.
And why is that? What kind of thoughts and feelings did it stir up in you?
Well, after everything the Democrats have done, it makes you think it's some Democrats' attempt to get rid of him that way, since the high court threw out all of the other charges they had against him.
I was almost resigned to the fact that something like that was going to happen. The man has done nothing but promote violence and insurrection. His words after he got shot were fight, fight, fight. His vice president says the Democrats did it. It's the president's fault. I mean, but it's all, the whole thing has been violent. He wants people to fight. He wants them to rise up.
And about an hour drive west in Laramie, government reporter Chris Clements spoke with Jerry Peterson, Karen Guernsey, and Kate Walsh.
Well, I think it's pretty sad state of the country that we're so divided up and people cheer it, people are against it. You know, it's too bad.
Well, that's horrible. We shouldn't shoot people. We shouldn't hurt each other. But I still think that Trump should not win, you know. But I think it's that discourse is wrong, you know. We should discuss and we should talk and we should try to solve our problems, but not go about killing people or trying to kill people.
Oh, I don't think that's good for any party or for the whole country. It makes me sad that people resort to violence to try and make a statement or try to change the world. I think we need to change the world in other ways. It harkens back to earlier times in this country. I thought we were better than that, and we have to always strive to be better.
And further up north in Pinedale, our natural resources and energy reporter, Caitlin Tan, spoke with Bill Clevin, Brittany Williams, Fred Fluhot, and Jessica Kellett.
I don't think it's a healthy trajectory that we're on. If that type of violence enters into the political rhetoric or political process. So I think there just has to be openness and willing to listen, and not that you're going to, you know, end up saying, well, that's right, But you have to be open to listening because you're going to get good ideas that come out of listening.
I think it's really sad that this is what our politics have come to. I think we're better than this. And I would like to see all candidates involved federally, locally, statewide, just no matter where you're at, being respectful and kind to the other parties. And I think we can find a lot of middle ground if we sit down and have a true conversation about the issues and the policies.
Obviously, I've heard rumors of it through some military sources that I have. And I also, within the last week and a half, had a prophecy given that was said it was going to happen in the next couple of weeks. But he was not going to be killed. And so there's things going on behind the scenes a lot of people don't realize. I am following off-channel stuff, and they know what's going on.
Really sad that somebody tried to assassinate Trump. I think it's terrible, regardless of my party affiliation. And I think, you know, it threatens to just further divide our sense of us as Americans. And I hope that instead it kind of gives us a moment to pause and say, hey, we're all Americans and we all need to treat each other with respect.
Earlier this month, a heat wave broke records across the country and hit Wyoming hard. Most counties in the eastern part of the state were under heat advisories for multiple days, but the heat didn't just impact air temperatures. It also took a toll on water ecosystems. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports on how increased heat is impacting rivers, fish, and the guides that rely on them.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good, how are you?
Doing well.
Good.
Everything would be fine?
Inside the West Bank Angler's fly fishing shop in Wilson, long, sleek rods line the walls. There's boxes on boxes of brightly colored flies, some with hair, fur, and feathers. In the office at the back of the shop, owner Mike Dawes says guides are seeing water temperatures already creep close to 68 degrees, a number that basically means it's time to stop fishing for cold water species like trout.
You know, the water temperature's getting, you know, 66, 67 on the snake, and that just, never heard that before at this time of year.
Dawes says that's more normal for the middle of August. The company's been trying to get clients out earlier, and Dawes himself was doing the same during the heat wave a couple days ago.
We were putting the boat on floating at 6 in the morning, which is pretty magical, but also kind of a necessity.
Wyoming doesn't implement mandatory fishing closures like Montana does, but Dawes thinks it should and thinks the collective community of outfitters could also do more.
In general, I think in terms of the outfitting business, we're just behind a little bit. We need to catch up.
Catching up, in Dawes' opinion, could look like having fishing representation on the state's outfitting board. It could also mean getting all the agencies to collaborate on when it's time to shut down fishing. And as far as how those kinds of closures might impact his business?
I think I've been doing it long enough that if I was worried about it, I'm worrying about the wrong things.
Wyoming Game and Fish Regional Fisheries Supervisor Matt Hahn says there's two main things going on for fish when the water heats up. One
is just the physics of oxygen and water. So the warmer water is, the less dissolved oxygen that it can carry.
The second is physiological.
They end up putting a lot more energy into respiration, just trying to pull as much oxygen from the water as possible. If the water temperature continues to go up, the physiological response becomes more and more dire.
Getting caught on a fishing line only adds to that stress.
The fish obviously is trying to escape, and so that increases energy demand on the fish at a time when it doesn't have a lot of excess energy to expend on such things.
Hahn says different fish are adapted for different temperature ranges.
If you're above 68 and you're trout fishing, you're starting to get into the lower end of the stressful range for those fish.
Three rivers in the northwest corner of Yellowstone National Park got to that point. On July 15th, the agency announced that it was closing fishing on the Madison, Firehole, and Gibbon Rivers, and most of their tributaries. The agency pointed to warm water temperatures and low river flows. John Schilling is the manager of Madison River Outfitters in West Yellowstone. He says local outfitters stopped fishing weeks before the closure, and the park could be way more proactive.
We usually, on our own, stop fishing them by July 1st every year because they're just too hot. And actually, the federal government, in our opinion, should automatically close them no matter what.
Schilling says that's the norm for most guiding companies in West Yellowstone, too. They normally start fishing again on the fire hole in September. And he thinks Yellowstone should follow suit.
There's still fish in there that you can catch, but it's just, it's not good for them. Too stressful. So we've still got lots of water.
Boots Allen works for the Snake River Fund, a stewardship and advocacy nonprofit back in Jackson. He says dealing with hot water temperatures is a relatively new topic in the industry.
It wasn't until like the late 90s, early 2000s that this became an issue in the fishing world.
Allen is also a senior fishing guide at Snake River Angler. He started gathering his own data on the river over two decades ago. He says in the last few years, water temps have been breaking the 68-degree threshold. In 2022, the max was 71 degrees. And although Wyoming Game and Fish and Grand Teton National Park don't issue closures like Yellowstone has, Allen says they do sometimes issue recommendations.
Once you cross the 68-degree mark, the general recommendation is to finish your fishing at about 3 p.m.
Allen says water temperatures tend to peak between 4 and 7 p.m. each day, and the fish stop biting when it gets too hot. He adds that there are other precautions anglers should take, regardless of water temperature.
When you hook your fish, try and get that fish in as quickly as possible.
He says people should also wet their hands to keep the fish's protective slime layer intact and to help keep the fish cool. Allen says some guides are taking all of August off, and he's cutting down his own days then too. He's seeing the shoulder seasons get a lot busier, but the downstream waters of the fishing industry look a little bit murky.
If it gets to a point where they have to shut down fishing in the future, might not be in my lifetime, it might be in my kid's lifetime, that's something we'll just deal with.
Allen says guides will have to keep adapting, even if it means hanging up their rod. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Wyoming is now considered a news desert. Why? Find out next on Open Spaces.
Did you know that all six episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Wyoming is lucky to still have a newspaper in every county. But last year, the Casper Star Tribune stopped producing a daily newspaper, going to 3 a week. Now there are no more daily papers in the state, and that qualifies Wyoming as a news desert.
For example, like Fremont County is bigger than the state of Massachusetts. And you're thinking about, like, if you get something twice a month, how much news are you actually getting?
That's Cindy Price Schultz, the head of the journalism department at the University of Wyoming. She's been studying the economic factors behind Wyoming's declining news environment. She sat down with Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards to talk about her findings.
I wonder if there is a way in which social media is filling a void, or some of these online news sources that might be kind of partisan, or they might be printing press releases without any sort of editing whatsoever. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how some of those online news sources, including social media, are filling a void.
Yeah, I've done some research related to the Pew studies, and Pew does a very great job of national interpretation of how people are getting their news. And many people are getting their news from social media. And so they just make their decisions without really screening for if it is true or not. And so more people are not getting the more traditional journalism screening of information and trying to balance information and give people things to think about. And when I was brought up to learn the traditional objectivity of journalism, you know, it's somewhat giving the people what they need to know rather than what they want to know. Like, here you can have your oatmeal for breakfast because, you know, you need it. But people are often more attracted to the more interesting, fun type stories. And then that also does go along with, there's been a lot of studies more recently about people being attracted to the news that they are already interested in and kind of reinforcing their current belief system. And so it would make sense in a state like Wyoming that since a lot of people have similar belief systems, that they would gravitate towards a news outlet that would give them those types of news stories. Wyoming is the most cynical state in the United States against traditional journalism. And usually what they say is, we don't dislike the journalists in my town, but we just don't like the national journalists, and that journalism in general then kind of gets a bad rap. But they're like, well, local journalism isn't so bad.
And it seems like one of the things that is getting lost as like newspapers are getting smaller and smaller, staffs are getting, you know, reduced, their pay is getting reduced. One of the first things to go is the editor position, it feels like. You know, there might still be somebody who is putting out some news, but there isn't necessarily somebody who's going to play that role of asking the hard questions of that reporter and getting them to think outside the box when they might kind of find themselves making assumptions as a reporter.
It's really all based on money, because it costs money to, if a person is higher up in the chain of management, then they get more money. So if it's, you know, cheaper to hire just a reporter than it is to have an editor, then that reporter may be really new out of college and doesn't really know how to edit themselves. And then that isn't necessarily the fault of that person because they're still learning their job. The people oftentimes don't have that mentorship like they used to.
I know that one of the other issues that some small town newspapers are dealing with is just the cost of printing the papers, that is one of the problems that you're hearing from small town newspapers. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, with the cost of the actual paper itself has gone up, and then the cost of printing has gone up, and then also the cost of postage. And there's been a lot of discussions at the national level about how these issues are affecting specifically newspapers and how that is a detriment to democracy. The actual paper itself is higher. So then now we see, you know, maybe smaller sizes of the papers because, you know, they can't do the big broadsheets anymore. So maybe they're just doing the smaller papers because that costs the same now as maybe a broadsheet did 10 years ago.
One of the things that it seems like that is causing a lot of the reduction in staffs at a lot of these news organizations is consolidation. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about what you have noticed over the years and how it has affected the size of staff, how much they're being able to pay.
Some background, my doctorate dissertation was partially related to budget cuts, and that was back in the 90s. So in the 90s, they were starting to do a lot of these consolidations. Then in 1996, when they did the Communications Act, because there was a limit on the number of stations that you could own, or TV stations, or that a TV station could own a newspaper, there was limits on that. Well, they took away those limits. And so now you see really big companies like, say, Town Square Media or Clear Channel on the broadcasting side. Or you'll see some other Gannett and Lee and some other very large newspaper groups. And so instead of becoming news, which was defended by the First Amendment of the Constitution, and that the freedom of the press and the free speech, all of those things that we hold dear in the United States, it's becoming a commodity. And the commodity then is news, rather than news itself being important. And therefore, it's all about money. There are still places in Wyoming that are owned locally, and they still really care about the news in their communities. And so I'm not saying that doesn't exist, because it does, but it's just less so than it used to be. Let's even say 30 years ago, when it was starting to see some consolidations, now just the consolidations seem to get more massive. And then on the other side, some journalists who are running a newspaper but can't get someone else to take over for them when they are trying to retire. And that has become an issue in many parts of the U.S., especially more rural areas, where maybe the money that you could make as even, say, an editor of a paper isn't enough where you could live in that community, where you couldn't even rent an apartment hardly. Several of the mountain towns in this state are very expensive. And if you're not even making enough money, you can hardly pay rent. You know, is that a place that you're going to get somebody else to be able to live there? And so then that becomes another issue of, we can't get a human that wants to take over. And that's really unfortunate for the communities and for the future of journalism in those areas.
We've been speaking with Cindy Price-Schultz, the department head for the Communications and Journalism Department at the University of Wyoming. Thanks so much, Cindy, for sitting down and talking to me.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
Coming up, we learn about races to keep an eye on in Southwest Wyoming. This is Open Spaces.
Hey there, this is Kelly Trujillo. Join me Saturday mornings for Buffalo Grass, 11 to 1, on listener-supported Wyoming Public Radio. You'll hear the best in bluegrass music, old and new, plus Americana, folk, Western, and even a little bit of Celtic. That's Buffalo Grass, Saturdays at 11 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. And now to The Road to Cheyenne, our special series previewing the primary elections. This week, we're previewing state legislative races in the southwest corner of the state, and we'll take a deeper look at the Republicans challenging Wyoming lone House seat occupied by Harriet Hageman currently. I have Caitlin Tan with me. While she's our natural resources and energy reporter, she lives in Pinedale, so she helped parse out the races in that area. And state government reporter Chris Clements is back. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to be here.
So for the purposes of this show, we're looking at two main races that encompass Pinedale, Big Piney, over to Cokeville, then to Kemmer, Green River, and down to the Utah border west of the Flaming Gorge. Caitlin, you've been talking to people in these areas. How are they feeling?
Yeah, well, you know, I posted up outside the rec center in Pinedale, and we're well into summer tourist season right now. So in my mind, I thought this is where I can find locals, but it turns out not really.
Sorry to bother you guys. My name's Caitlin, and I'm just trying to talk to Wyoming people. Oh, we're from Idaho.
Oh,
I'm
you
sorry.
Are? No worries. Sorry. Okay, no worries. And then I met others from Colorado, Utah, California. I bring this up because Southwest Wyoming, especially Pinedale, is increasingly becoming a tourist hub. And it's kind of a place for second homes and an overflow area for people who can't afford to live in Jackson.
Were you able to find any locals?
Yeah, of course. It just honestly took a few hours. But actually, tourism and housing were top of mind. I caught Brittany Williams. She's in her late 30s and a lifelong Sublette County resident.
I don't like to see our community outpriced. And to know that my kids probably won't be able to move back here or ever start a family here because it's too expensive, that's my biggest concern locally.
Since 2019, the average cost of a house has gone up more than $150,000. And the average cost is also about $100,000 more than the state as a whole.
Yikes, that's a lot for 5 years.
Oh, yeah. And people kind of partly blame this on tourism. The area has historically depended on natural gas and agriculture, but has increasingly leaned on tourism, and it's, you know, putting places like Pinedale on the map. And it's not just a feeling. The area is growing. There's a state report that shows that Sublette County is the fastest growing county in Wyoming. Williams and others I spoke with say that they hope local politicians can have some sway on what the future of Southwest Wyoming looks like.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about the candidates. There's two main races, right?
Yeah, two main races. So I'll start with the Senate District 14 seat. There are three candidates. The first is Republican Albert Summers, who most of you are probably familiar with.
Yes, if you pay attention to the legislative session at all, you do. He has had a lot of influence in the House of Representatives for some time now.
Yeah, so he's been in his House seat since 2013. The last two legislative sessions, he was actually Speaker of the House. And, you know, Summers is a lifelong Sublette County rancher. He's well known for his conservation work also.
So what are some of the bills he's sponsored? And do you think we could expect similar work from him if he wins this Senate seat?
Yeah, so a lot of Summers' work has revolved around conservation and honestly preservation of Wyoming lands. Just in Summers' personal life, he's very open that he put his ranch under a conservation easement, so it can't really ever be developed. But in the lawmaking world, Summers has long tried to pass legislation that regulate commercially guided fishing boats. He talks about his concerns about fisheries being overfished, which is a growing issue in Sublette County. He's also openly in favor of a new law that gave locals a head start with shed antler hunting season.
He's done a lot since he's been in the seat for 10 years. So did he have any close runs during that time for his seat?
Honestly, not a lot. He's pretty well loved in the area. He's seen as a voice for ranchers and old timers. And he honestly has decent support from both Democrats and Republicans. So in past elections, he's mostly won by like a 98% vote. But I will say 2 years ago, candidate Mike Schmid gave him a run for his money in the primary. I do think that last election could be a little telling.
How so?
Well, you know, Summers is seen as an old school traditional Republican, and a newer, further right sect of the party, the Freedom Caucus, is growing in popularity and honestly made Summers' job as Speaker of the House very tricky the last couple years.
Right. Summers actually wrote an op-ed in 2023 asking, why does the Freedom Caucus tell its members how to vote? And then during this year's legislative session, he dealt with an unprecedented number of committee bills getting killed the very first day, which was due to an alignment of Freedom Caucus members. And the budget only got approved the last day of the session.
Yeah. So, you know, Summers might have his work cut out for him in this election. He's running against Laura Pearson of the Kemmer area. Now, I should say she's not officially part of the Freedom Caucus, but she shares a lot of their content on her campaign's Facebook page.
So who's she? I don't think I've heard of her in a political office before.
Yeah, that's right. Pearson stresses she's not a politician. On her website, there's a big emphasis on the fact that she's a fourth generation sheep rancher, a school bus driver, and a small business owner.
Just curious, what's her business?
New trend hats. So they're basically hats that have holes for high ponytails.
Definitely not politics. Okay, but she's running. So what is her political stance?
You know, she's pro-gun, pro-life, anti-transgender rights, pro-limited government. She's also shared content on her campaign's Facebook page that pushes back on climate change, a stance that's increasingly popular in the Freedom Caucus Party.
And there's one more candidate.
Yeah, so Bill Winnie, a Sublette County Republican. He's run for a House seat 6 times and never won, but he keeps trying, this time with the Senate. Notably, he's a familiar face in the legislature. Winnie has been known to move to Cheyenne temporarily for the session. He notoriously testifies on almost all topics, just as a Wyoming resident, not as a lobbyist or anything.
Interesting. So what's his stance on things?
Well, he really leans into his experience from being a 30-year Navy veteran. He was involved with the country's Navy nuclear submarine program and some of its financial involvements. So he draws a line between that and Wyoming, saying that it kind of puts him in a position to help the state spend its money wiser.
Okay, well, there's one other race to debrief, right?
Yeah, so it's the House District 20 seat. This one represents Pinedale, Big Piney, and LaBarge. This is Summers' former seat. And so remember earlier when I mentioned Mike Schmid?
Right, the guy who gave Summers a run for his money 2 years ago.
Yeah, well, he's running again. So a little background on Schmid. He started an oil and gas service company based in LaBarge. And you might have heard his name quite a bit over the last year. He's been pretty vocal on wildlife issues. He's a self-proclaimed wildlife advocate, but he's pushed back on any further protections for big game in western Wyoming. He's actually openly against any official state designation of the Sublette Pronghorn Migration Corridor, which could potentially limit energy development along it.
Wasn't he involved with the Game and Fish?
Yeah, actually, he was a board member for the Wyoming Game and Fish Commission from 2017 to early 2021. Governor Mark Gordon actually removed him suddenly, citing that Schmid was undermining the effectiveness of the board. Interestingly, it was shortly after news came out that Schmid had attended the pro-Trump January 6th rally that resulted in an attack on our Capitol, although the governor's office insists that didn't play a role in their decision to dismiss him.
So what are some of his stances?
Again, he's not officially part of the Freedom Caucus, and his stances definitely align with them. And he's also historically been involved on the party's Facebook page. But a couple of his positions, you know, property tax relief and supporting the oil and gas industry.
Got it. And then running against him?
Sheep rancher Kat Urbikite from Boulder, Wyoming. She's also a photographer and author. She's penned several books on wildlife and local ranching culture.
And what are her political stances?
So she's definitely the more moderate of the two. She's endorsed actually by Summers. And Urbikite's main issues are transparency in government and limited government. She's also a big proponent of state management of wildlife, not federal.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Caitlin, for that deep dive into those two pretty important races in the Southwest. And now, Chris, Harriet Hageman is up for re-election. She's finishing up her first term as Wyoming's lone congressional representative. What has she done since she was elected in 2022?
Well, she didn't waste time in joining the far-right House Freedom Caucus, which some Democrats and even some Republicans have described as an obstructionist and pretty polarizing faction of the GOP. As a former water rights litigator, Hageman has sponsored a number of bills going after the federal government's land and energy policies in the state. She's also routinely either a sponsor or a co-sponsor of legislation having to do with pretty controversial social wedge issues, like one that would abolish so-called woke awards from the National Institute of Health, and another that would ban transgender athletes from competing in the Olympics. For the last one that I just mentioned, Hageman was the only legislator actually carrying the bill in a pretty combative committee hearing on Capitol Hill a few months ago. And when I asked her about it, Hageman pushed back, and she told me she sees that legislation as being pretty straightforward.
If you want to describe that as a divisive social issue, that's fine. Go ahead and do it. I'm just telling you, I'm going to continue to sponsor bills that are designed to protect women.
Then I followed up by asking how common of an occurrence she thinks it is for trans women, who she refers to as men, to compete alongside women in the Olympics. And she said,
too common. If it's one person, it's too much.
Critics and LGBTQ advocates call that bill harmful and discriminatory against trans folks, and that it addresses a situation that's so rare, it basically amounts to a non-issue. And switching gears for a second, Hageman also chairs the Subcommittee on Indian and Insular Affairs, which oversees all 574 federally recognized tribes in the U.S., and that includes Wyoming's Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes. And in that capacity, she's sponsored a lot of legislation centered on the tribes, like a bill that was introduced this week that would mean Indian Health Service employees must receive training in tribal history and Indian culture. And I asked Hageman about that measure.
We heard from tribal leaders from around the country. It was very interesting as they talk about some of the challenges that they have and how to be a bit more culturally sensitive when we're providing services, say, with Indian Health Services.
Okay, so Hageman's done a lot, but she still has one Republican challenger during this primary. That's Stephen Helling. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Absolutely. Steve Helling is an attorney in Casper, and he's a former registered Democrat, actually. He ran as a pro-Trump Democrat for this same seat in the 2022 primaries against Lynette Graybull, and he lost. But this time, he's running as a Republican. And so I asked Helling why Republican voters should trust him after running for the opposing party.
Looking back, I would say that was a mistake. And the voters saw through that. And rejected my Democrats for Trump. I was hopeful that the Democratic Party in Wyoming would want to send a message to Washington.
He told me his main focus, if elected, would be to pass legislation to stop the construction of nuclear energy plants like the one planned for Kemmer. Helling describes them as unsafe for Wyomingites.
So does Hageman seem at all worried about her seat? Has she been campaigning in the state?
If she's worried about losing her seat, Camila, it did not come across to me. She was at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee when I spoke with her, and she told me she's been holding campaign events and town halls across the state. She said she's going to be in Cheyenne this weekend for Frontier Days. And in general, she told me she's made it a priority to try to hold a town hall in every county in Wyoming every year.
If Hageman loses, does that show Wyoming isn't happy with anyone in Congress?
Well, look, I think her odds of losing are very low. As her only primary challenger, Steve Helling just doesn't have the same kind of name recognition and support that Hageman has, especially after she defeated Cheney in 2022 and won an endorsement from Donald Trump, and the affection, honestly, of a lot of Wyomingites.
Right. And like you said, we're talking about the primaries, but there is a Democrat on the ballot. So who will the final Republican be against in the general?
Yeah, that'll be Kyle G. Cameron. She told Northern Wyoming News her main reason for running is to expand reproductive rights, especially after the state's abortion ban passed. And that ban is held up in federal court right now, along with a few other abortion-related measures. So the procedure remains legal for right now.
Well, thank you so much, Chris and Caitlin. That's a wrap for this edition of The Road to Cheyenne. And if you have any questions about voting, the electoral process, specific races, or candidates, feel free to give us a call and leave us a voicemail at 307-766-4314. We may use your voicemail on the show, or go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and scroll down to our America Amplified banner to fill out a form to ask questions. The Road to Cheyenne will be back on the next Open Spaces, which is August 2nd, and we'll be looking at the last quadrant of the state, the Southeast. You can also find this series online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It's summertime in Wyoming. That means rodeos and music festivals. More about both up next on Open Spaces.
Check out the Wyoming Public Radio Politics Quiz. Are you up to date on the latest state government news? If so, test that knowledge out. In this week's quiz, a homeless shelter in Cheyenne is trying to turn what former business into affordable housing units? Think you know the answer? Find out at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click the WPR Politics Quiz tab.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The annual Grand Teton Music Festival is happening now through mid-August, and this summer, the festival is offering more family programs, more summer music camps, and more free concerts in Jackson and across the pass in Idaho. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Rosalie Duvall heads to some events and found that many programs are seeing record turnout.
As the orchestra starts into the first notes of its first piece outside the Center for the Arts in downtown Jackson, the effect, among the kids in attendance, is almost immediate. The annual Grand Teton Music Festival family concert turns into a dance party. And young Kate Hernandez knows why.
Because it's music. Music is fun.
Over 1,000 people came to the event held on July 3rd. Jackson's youngest wiggled and marched to the music. Their families enjoyed picnics in the grass. Kate's mom, Mireya Hernandez, says it was an impressive showing.
They sound amazing. All together is just like, wow, it's amazing, you know?
It's just one of dozens of events this summer. The Grand Teton Music Festival features over 250 musicians from around the world. This summer, the festival is featuring more free community concerts and family programming than ever.
Thank you so much for joining us today, the Grand Teton Music Festival Orchestra.
Emceeing the concert is Megan Heinrich, or Miss Megan with the purple hair, to her young students. She is GTMF's education coordinator. She's worked with the festival's community programs for years, providing musical education for all ages. This year, she's busier than ever.
Just a few things going on.
She's excited about the expansion. The community has more opportunities to connect with renowned classical artists.
So this year, almost every single On the Road concert is a different group of musicians. So we're getting more and more musicians who are interested in being a part of the education and community programs, getting out into the community and performing.
Like Juan Degomar, contrabassoonist in the Atlanta Symphony, who's been coming to the festival for 24 years.
I love interacting with little kids and having them see instruments up close and touch the instruments and feel how the instruments feel when they're making their sound. And they light up. They just get these big smiles. I think it's important to serve our community, and our community is the greater Jackson Hole area. And the more we can do that, the better.
One of the goals of the festival is to make classical music more accessible. Degomar says he thinks some may feel intimidated at the prospect of an orchestra concert.
I totally get that. I was too the first time. Please, please, please come. I think you might be surprised how welcoming a place it is. It really is a community coming together.
Megan Heinrich agrees. She says demystifying music really isn't that complicated.
Any musical experience is a good musical experience. There's no right or wrong way to do it.
That's why she implements programming for kids at a young age. Days after the concert, she's at a downtown green space with about 60 hip-high children and their families for a musical adventures program aimed at children ages 1 through 5.
One thing that I always take the time to do, I get every kid's name, and I sing every kid's name directly to them. And it's such a little thing, and maybe I only remember the names for that hours, but for, you know, a 2-year-old to see someone, look them in the eye, and sing their name to them, that makes a pretty special connection. It makes them want to keep coming back.
And Heinrich hopes they continue to do just that, come back. Because as participation and interest grows, the festival's programming will grow with it. For KHOL News, I'm Rosalie Duvall.
Wonderful. Let's see if we can get it even louder this time. Goodbye, goodbye. It's time to go. Goodbye, goodbye. I don't want to go. See you later.
Cheyenne Frontier Days is happening now and goes through the 28th. This year, they're calling it the Year of the Cowgirl, highlighting the spirit and strength of Western women throughout history. A new novel recently titled Sunny Gale by Jamie Lisa Forbes was inspired by women who competed in rodeo in the late 1800s into the early 1900s. Wyoming Public Radio's Grady Kirkpatrick spoke with the author about her inspiration for the book.
Well, as you can see, I spent about 40 years in Wyoming total and was very familiar with rodeo. We were either at Jubilee Days or Frontier Days or both every summer. And I had never heard of women riding Bronx or doing any of the things that I later learned that they had done. And when I first learned of the history, I was just incredulous. I thought this could never have happened where I live. And in fact, I learned it had happened. And when I learned the nature and of extent of it, how many women were involved over two generations, I felt so sad because, first of all, I had never got to see them or never got to learn of them. And second of all, I was sad that the history had been so obscure that there was no depiction of it, no memorial to it, no nothing about it in all the years I lived in Wyoming. And so I took the time to go and learn about these women and as much as I could about the stories of their lives. I wanted to have them live again the way they must have lived at the time.
Yeah, and one of the women back in the day, Prairie Rose Henderson, was a big part of the inspiration, right?
She was for a number of reasons. One of the reasons I found her inspiring was because she was one of the first, mm-hmm. one of the very first to show up at an arena and say, I can ride Bronx. She had started out horse racing. I knew that. And I knew that from the Cheyenne Frontier Days programs, because they had listed her under her first married name as winning either a horse race or a relay race. I knew she'd started out that way, but eventually she showed up at either Frontier Days or another rodeo and started riding Bronx. And she was one of the first to do so. And then, of course, her costumes. She had amazing costumes, and I'll just direct your listeners to go look at the pictures. Amazing costumes that she made herself or had her relatives make for her. And then there was, you know, her pluck in sticking with it for so many years. She continued to perform until her middle age. Mm-hmm. And all of these things I found inspiring about her, even though she did have a very tragic end.
Yeah. Describe the setting where the story begins with young Hannah Brandt, who eventually changes her name to Sunny Gale.
Hannah Brandt and her family have moved to the Sandhills of Nebraska from Ohio. Hannah's father has passed away. Before he died, he and his wife had made plans to move to the Sandhills, where they'd heard that everything was going to be just wonderful, building a farm in the Sandhills. Hannah's mother ends up marrying her husband's brother, who is not as industrious as the father. Nevertheless, they still make the move to Nebraska, where they encounter numerous difficulties that they're not able to overcome. Mm-hmm. They're not able to raise cattle. They suffer from drought, which I did read there was a drought in that period in Nebraska, and they basically failed pioneers. By the time Hannah wants to start riding, she knows her parents are failing as settlers in Nebraska.
Yeah. She develops a love of her natural surroundings, horses, and soon wants to race and compete against the cowboys. The year was 1897 when Hannah and her new husband, Luke Mangum, see a poster advertising a cowboy and cowgirl competition, a rodeo, first of its kind in Cheyenne. There's a passage in the novel that describes their wagon ride from Nebraska into Wyoming and arriving at the very first Cheyenne Frontier Day. I think it was just one day back then.
It was one day.
I'd love for you to read the passage when they first arrive in Cheyenne.
Mr. and Mrs. Luke Mangum drove to Cheyenne in a wagon with Helios and a second horse tied to the back. When Hannah saw the Cheyenne lights flare across the prairie, she grabbed Luke's arm and squeezed it. They were alive to share this moment together. Hannah was in love again. Down the main thoroughfare, at least 10 bars were lit, open, and overflowing. Music poured out into the street, a cacophony of reels, cakewalks, polkas, waltzes. Knots of cowboys jostled one another under the streetlights. One was trying to ride his horse into a bar while others cheered him on. Even the women were loud. Many of them smoked cigarettes as they hung onto their men's arms.
Jamie Lisa Forbes reading from her novel, Sunny Gale. Sunny defies convention of the times with her drive to compete in a predominantly male-oriented sport. She's among the first women in the bronc riding event. And what was it, you think, that inspired her so much to compete?
In my fictional telling of it, she's already doing horse racing when she goes to the Frontier Days, just as I read, and she meets a Native American girl named Eleanor, who also is a horse racer at that point. And Eleanor's husband is in the bronc riding. So they watch the first ever bronc riding at Cheyenne Frontier Days, which is a men's event at that point. And Eleanor just turns to her and says, I can do that too. I can do, and Sunny, who is still Hannah at that point, is flabbergasted by that idea. But she is inspired by Eleanor's desire to push that envelope and go even farther and stretch her horsemanship even more. And it's based on Eleanor's words that Eleanor's going to do it, that Sunny decides she's going to do it too.
Yeah. The story's set in other parts of Wyoming, including Medicine Bow and around the historic Virginian Hotel. It's certainly a timely book coinciding with the Year of the Cowgirl at Cheyenne Frontier Days, and also a bronze statue of a cowgirl without stirrups.
Without the hobbled stirrups.
Yeah, without the hobbled stirrups, yep. It's a great story, not just for rodeo fans. What do you hope 21st century readers will experience and take away from Sunny Gale?
I hope readers are going to be moved by the book. What I want the readers to take away is that this is history that has not been celebrated. But more than that, it's a story of trying to reach the heights of glory and ambition and immortality and being undercut by your own choices, which is what happens to Sunny Gale. And I think that is a human story. More and beyond that, I think the reader can tell that I personally love the West. I love the openness and the magnificence of the West. And I want the reader to come away with that feeling of magnificence.
Yes. You want to tell us about any of your early rodeo experiences at Cheyenne Frontier Days? You've attended a number.
Yeah, because my father's family is from Cheyenne, and we had a lot of friends in Cheyenne. We were at Frontier Days quite a bit from the time I was a child all the way through adulthood. My son and I were at Frontier Days when the bull rider was killed in the late 1980s. We were there when that happened. And that was the first message to me that fatalities can happen anytime at rodeo. And so it wasn't hard for me at that point to imagine the fatalities that happened for women and the one that I wrote about in the book.
Yeah. Jamie Lisa Forbes, author of Sunny Gale, available from Pronghorn Press at bookstores, on Amazon, or via ebooks on Kindle. Jamie Lisa Forbes, it's been a great pleasure talking with you, and thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure for me, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Melody Edwards, today's audio producer. And thank you, Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.